of how it's going to be spent. And that's what we've been doing over the past several months, is working with the Needs and Funding Advisory Committee, keeping the modal groups involved, and coming up with a list that the people who are most engaged seem to think is a pretty good list to start with.
I think the intention is to bring the second three-year list back to council, right? When we get to the next cycle.
Right. So, but we're talking about $120 million that are being identified as the first batch here for the first 3 years. And there hasn't been an opportunity for the public to weigh in on, you know, is $3 million here going, is $3 million going here versus here? And that's a concern to me, because, like I said, it's a whole different level of magnitude from what we've been used to. And we need to make sure that there's input from the whole council as well as from the public.
To what extent do we do that with the other bureaus? I mean, BES and Water do a lot of individual projects each year. And how much public input do we have on them?
They bring the capital improvements plan to us on a yearly basis, and then we approve the rates that then cover that capital improvement plan. So every year the council has the opportunity to look at, for instance, the proposed filtration plant in the Bull Run, which we decided not to do. So, and for system development charges for parks, I've had allocations that for over the next 5 years are less than what this would be per year.
Okay, I think I misunderstood what you meant by public process. You're talking about general council oversight, not widespread public outreach project by project?
Well, there's that as well, and that's something else that needs to be considered. In our park system development plan, project plan, in each project, there's going to be community involvement in that. What? So as to what the capacity is for your staff to have the appropriate amount of input, you know, for instance, on the changes to Capitol Highway, since people have been working on that for a long time, there's going to need to be a revised public process. I don't mean to make this more complicated than it is. I'm just highlighting this.
I think it's a good question. I think maybe another thing to look at would be, having built capital budgets for transportation for a while, we would make it really clear when we're proposing our new budget every year on the operating side and the capital side, here's the proposed projects that we're putting into our capital budget that are consistent with this plan. And in that conversation, I'm sure things are going to come up. Capitol Highway 1 would be a good example. Between now and when we collect some revenue, we're going to have enough information to figure out whether that project really can move forward. And so we'd be coming to council saying, we have these targets that we've set up. We have this initial list of projects. Here's some additional information. The advisory committee would be giving you recommendations, but ultimately council would be in that position of saying, these are the projects that we want to move forward with in that normal budgeting process. All these projects would be incorporated in that.
That's very helpful. So that the specific capital improvement list per each year comes to council as part of the budgeting of the budget process. That's where people have their public input, and that's where changes to this proposal could be made.
Exactly. I mean, that's what we've tried to do, I think with some success, around the community school and traffic safety partnership. You know, 8 years ago, when we established some of that traffic safety count revenue, we use that advisory committee every year to give us some recommendations, which we incorporate in our budget. Probably need to do a better job of communicating that to council. Then council ultimately is making that decision about how to spend the money.
The capital improvements plan, just like any other bureau, is an ingredient in the budget, which the council hears and adopts.
Right.
So how much front end and what kind of front end process beyond the Bureau Advisory Committee or the Deeds and Funding Advisory Committee or anything else is still open to our discretion? So
yeah,
it's not a new thing for PBOT to have a capital improvements plan. It's just this is a new revenue source with a new list attached to it.
With a whole lot more. Yes, yeah, so that's the answer, is that these are not set in stone, that they are coming back each year. And
exactly. Exactly.
That's fine.
Yeah, okay. And I think, you know, both the committees and the Bureau have been thoughtful about this, but it's impossible to get a completely satisfactory answer, not because people are being evasive, but because this stuff changes. I mean, it changes a lot on the maintenance side, which makes it hard to do advance lists on the maintenance side. You know, a water line blows up, and there we go. There's a maintenance project because the pavement's got to be replaced. on the capital side, like Mark mentioned, you know, we'll get a grant from somebody, Metro, ODOT, whatever, that we applied for but don't know if we're going to get, and then that takes down part of the cost of one of these projects. So I think we have to have a list that says to the public, essentially, this is what we think we're going to do, plus or minus. And the council needs to have eyes on that, but then with an understanding that there's going to be plus and minus.
Yeah. Mayor, is it therefore the intent to have the oversight body formally weigh in during our budget process to give any feedback to the council on priorities for the next fiscal year?
I like that idea. Yes, thank you. Pray that we need it. But I think we will.
So I should have mentioned on the protected bike lane routes this morning, Marianne Fitzgerald, who I think might be here, was at that meeting and had made a really good point, I think, especially for Southwest, of saying, you know, neighbor greenways have worked really well in other parts of town because there's a grid and there's, you know, you can find an alternative street that's not, has tons of elevation, which is very hard to do in Southwest, and wanted us to add a row, which we'll do for this for the Needs and Funding Advisory Committee on Thursday, that identified separated bike facilities in Southwest Portland that we identify in the SWIM project. I think East Portland and Southwest actually are, and part of why you don't see more projects in this category right now is that there's actually some good community work that needs to happen in both those communities before we figure out what are those separated facilities that can really work on some of those busier streets. And especially in Southwest, there's just more work that needs to be done. So in that, hopefully in the 4 to 6 year time horizon, we can get more into that. Onto the page 7, the neighborhood greenways, and this the next couple projects are example of some of that work that we're doing on residential streets. So this list that you see here is dominated to a large degree by projects that have been identified in the East Portland in Motion project. Projects like the 4M project and the Holiday Oregon Pacific project are really key elements of that network that's going to provide alternatives, access to Gateway, to, you know, some of those busier street routes. The Northeast Southeast 80th project is a really good example of one of those neighbor greenways that gives people an alternative to 82nd Avenue when they want to get to a lot of those destinations. In general, as I've reviewed this list with East Portland Action Plan, their bike advisory committee, EPIM's bike advisory committee, the sense I've got from it is they feel like that this project really is prioritizing East Portland safety investments like nothing we've ever done before. And if you look at that map over here in the corner, it's included in your packet too, that shows concentrations of poverty or lower incomes. You'll see that our safety expenditures are really focused in that area more than any plan that I've worked on in the past. And it's great to see as much community support for that. I mean, there's safety projects across the city, but we really have prioritized East Portland like we haven't done in the past. So the last two categories I'm going to talk about are alternative street design and then safe routes. So on alternative street design, what we've included in here are three different projects. The first one includes a city subsidy for gravel streets. So as council knows well, we developed a street-by-street proposal that would allow us to develop an alternative street standard on low-volume streets. Some of these streets are currently gravel. The existing process just really hasn't moved forward without some kind of a subsidy. Our recommendation here is that we start to provide some subsidy, a means-based, with also, you know, an incentive to fund those projects that provide the most connectivity to schools and access to transit and that sort of thing. In addition to that, that picture that you see here is an example of a project in Southwest on Maplewood, Southwest Maplewood, where we were able to work really productively with the Bureau of Environmental Services to figure out how, when we do a ditch maintenance project, we can get a 4-foot shoulder. We also do traffic calming, and you can see here speed reduction. And it's really an effective way for us in certain locations to provide a safer place for people to walk and bike. This doesn't mean that we would do the same kind of treatment on like a Barber Boulevard or a Powell or something like that. But there's certain streets like this where this makes a lot of sense. In addition to that, there's been some really good work done in the Coley neighborhood on some alternative street design, and we've identified that as a project need as well. So my last part of this project's proposal highlights our proposed allocation of resources to safe routes to schools. This is the last page, page 8. And what we've done here is we've summarized the proposed allocation to schools based on high school clusters. And so there's the elementary schools, obviously, that make up those clusters. That's where we've been focusing our safety improvements. If we can, since elementary schools cover the whole of the city. If we make those safety improvements, you know, our hope is that we're making the whole neighborhood safe. One thing that I'm really proud of in this proposal, as the Safe Routes group has put this together, is that they're using some nice criteria that not only helps us figure out where the needs are the greatest from a crash perspective, but also look at some things like concentration of kids on free and reduced lunch and other factors like that, so that we can make sure that in those neighborhoods where kids are walking out of necessity, that we've really invested in the kind of safety improvements that can make it so kids can safely get to school. And you can see here we have examples of some of the projects that have been identified in those plans. And obviously, if we get this funding, we'll be doing a lot of neighborhood work to further identify those projects.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Other questions?
Go ahead. I still want to get feedback. I have a comment and then a question. And the first is the comment. Thank you very much for publishing it at this size. This looks like one of my this is the size of the documents I get in my bureau check-ins, and I appreciate the font and the extra large component. On page one, you have a category called 6-year net revenue, and could you break that out for me so I better understand the assumptions behind that? In particular, net, and what you're estimating is your sort of recovery rate, your compliance rate, or the percentage you're collecting.
And I might need Ken Lee to come up and help me with this.
Ken Lee with Portland Bureau of Transportation. So you wanted to kind of see how we want do the walk from gross to net revenues, pretty much.
Just if you could explain so that even I could understand it, what you mean by 6-year net revenue.
Right. So 6-year net revenue is just basically the collection of our gross revenues over a 6-year period, and then taking away any of the leakage or what the compliance that we were not able to collect. On top of that, we also have to pay for their admin costs and some merchant fees. And that's what we end up netting over a 6-year period is $173 million. And it's broken out in the first 3 years, it's going to be a little less than the subsequent 4 to 6 years, but just because of the ramp-up time with the compliance.
And what is your best guesstimate of the rate of compliance by taxpayers?
So on the business side or the non-residential side, because we're leveraging the business license tax database, platform, we're expecting roughly about 90% compliance.
I'm sorry,
90% compliance on the non-residential, on the business side. On the residential, the income tax platform side, we're just following kind of the federal. It's between 83% to 85% compliance.
That's eventually, right?
Eventually, yes. In the first year, we don't expect to get that full 83%, 85%, but over time, for that first year, over the 2-year period, we'll get to 83%, 85%.
Thank you.
So why did you go with the arts tax mode of, rather than what we did with the Multnomah County iTax, where it was just a part of your federal state filing?
Partly it's because, you know, we already have the platform established, and so there's no additional one-time cost. We do actually have the experience of the Multnomah income tax as well that we did the administration for. Actually, Terry's the expert, so maybe she'll probably answer that better than me.
Terry's chomping at the bit to answer that one.
Terry Williams, Revenue Bureau. The iTax was actually not a part of the federal or state taxes. We used numbers from those returns and fed it into a local tax return, but it was a separate local tax return. So what we're proposing with this is to actually take both this income tax and the arts and combine it into a single income tax filing that would do a calculation for both of these all in one, so that we're not adding another additional return on folks, but we can get both of them filed on one return.
What's our current compliance with the arts tax?
The current compliance right now is 71%, and it's continuing to climb. And as we continue, increase, yes. Get bigger. I said climb. Get bigger. Oh, no, to go up. And as we continue our compliance efforts and matching programs and everything, then it will increase as well as time goes by.
And what would be the communication between federal and state returns and this proposed mechanism?
This proposed mechanism begins with adjusted gross income, which is the amount that's on the federal return. And so that would be the starting point. So the folks that are filing those returns, it would be very easy to feed that into that.
It's an amount that's on the federal return, but it's not the same as taxable income, right? It's a line on the federal return.
That's correct. It's a line on the federal return.
And what I guess my question was more, is the IRS going to be communicating with us in some way, or are we going to be communicating with them, or is this still kind of on the honor system?
No, in fact, we have entered an agreement with the Internal Revenue Service, and that has been approved to begin our data exchange program with them, and then it's supposed to start with in 2015, and we'll be getting 2013 tax data. So ongoing, that is a huge step for helping us both on the arts tax and with this potential proposal to increase that compliance and make sure that things are being reported correctly.
Speaking of the IRS, we need to check this with as many lawyers as possible, but it's our belief that as an income tax rather than a user fee, this would be tax deductible on your federal tax forms. So particularly for higher income people who tend to A, itemize, and B, pay a higher rate, they actually would not be paying out of pocket the amounts we're talking about. They'd be paying that amount minus whatever they're saving their federal taxes.
That's correct. It would be a deduction for those that itemize.
Okay. If we're at that point of clarification on those issues, I want to walk the council back through the sort of outstanding issues and raise some questions that we still need to resolve before we produce an ordinance, and then call staff back up as you need to. So just reviewing, first of all, on the mechanism side, the feedback was that it was too high. It's now spread across a lot more entities, now based on a tripartite formula instead of on trip generation. We still need to figure out a question that you've raised, Commissioner Fritz, which is how do we deal with very small businesses that are paying, that have a very small gross income, and the proprietor is under the threshold for income where they would have to pay personally. So I want to asterisk that issue. It's not still on the table. I assume you still want us to figure out a way to do that, and I think the staff is still attempting to figure out a way to do that, but that one is still in the air. And then on the residential side, we've moved from trip generation to income-based. The unresolved issue is the high-end cap. There are three different proposals in front of us, and you've seen the effects of changing that. We'll want to peg that somewhere for the ordinance that we put in front of the council, that we're not tied to 20, 100, or 200. There are other choices, obviously, as well. It's a little bit of a Goldilocks test, I think, for each of us as to what we think is appropriate there. I would probably fall around $50, but I'm interested in hearing where other people fall on that question. So maybe we take that issue on first. We also need to talk about some of these other issues. But in terms of the mechanism itself, how it's set up for business, how it's set up for residential, your reactions and guidance before we distill this into an ordinance.
So I'm not prepared to give guidance so much today. I appreciate the information. The third issue that I'm concerned about is the issue of the lower income exemption for couples filing jointly versus single. If it's appropriate for $25,000 for a single person, $30,000 doesn't seem high enough to me for that.
Okay.
I have a question addressed to Commissioner Novick. On the business side, at the committee level, was there any consideration of exempting certain size businesses in, say, year one, startups, small businesses, so that the burden wouldn't fall on them during a time of particular vulnerability but would kick in later? And if so, what was the thinking on that?
the mayor and I did such a stellar job of absenting ourselves from those proceedings that it could be a citizen process rather than politician-driven process that I actually do not know the answer. And I would ask staff to come up and give the answer to that question.
And by the way, I'm thinking particularly really of the sole proprietors. We've seen a big jump in business license fees. A lot of people are turning to starting their own businesses. Year one is obviously one of the most challenging years. I don't know what the fail rate is. I'm assuming it's very high. Was there some consideration to giving certain size businesses a pass in the first year or so?
Sort of. I guess the answer is it would not specifically. I don't remember that issue coming up of the startup business. One of the things, though, that did come up is, and it's part of the reason why when you look at that schedule that we have added the number of employees and the amount of gross receipts as well, as we did hear a lot in the early part of the second phase of this project from businesses that would say, you know, we're in a larger building. We might be in a building type that has a high trip generation rate, but our sales are so low or our number of employees are so low that we think we should be charged a lower rate. And that's why we added that criteria that allows you to be selected in a category based of two or three criteria, so that there was a way that some of those more marginal or lower performing businesses would be paying a lower rate.
Okay, thank you. And in light of what the mayor just said a moment ago about a potential fourth option on a cap, is it your intent to give us an updated document that shows us what that might look like if, for example, $50 was the sweet spot?
Yes, we can definitely do that and bring that back.
So just on the monthly street fee for businesses, just kind of speaking to Commissioner Fish's point about sole proprietors, so if you're 0 to 5 employees and you're less than 2,500 square feet, or let's say you're at 2,500 square feet, but you make less than 250,000 gross revenue, do you pay the tax or you don't pay the tax? Because you hit two of those three.
No, yeah, you would, depending on which group you would pay, you'd be in category A given those parameters, and you'd pay either $2.50 per month all the way up to $15 per month in that particular group.
Oh, so that's anything less than 250,000 in gross revenue.
Correct.
Any thought? I guess then speaking to Commissioner Fisher's point about sole proprietorships in their first year, many of those don't pay a business license fee because they don't produce sufficient income in the first year. Any thought about adjusting the lower limit to reflect something like that on this gross revenue?
Well, we have had discussions. I believe on the business license tax, if you gross less than $50,000 per year, you are exempt from paying the business license tax, and we have looked into that. I believe there's about 18,000 businesses within the city of Portland that fall under that category. Under this scenario, that would be about, I think, $2.5 million in revenue loss, and so it's definitely something that we've had some discussions about, but there's been no decisions made whether to exempt those particular businesses.
And how many total business filers are there again? 111,000?
Sorry. Well, under this scenario, I think there's 120,000.
Those are the locations, not the actual.
Okay, sorry. Locations.
Filers, I take it. Right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Right.
Commissioner, I would also note that although there is that provision in the business income tax, when it comes to other mechanisms by which we collect money, the property tax, water and sewer fees, we don't have any small business exemptions. They pay what everybody else pays based on the value of their property, as strained through Measure 5 and 47, and based on their water and sewer usage.
This set of issues, the mechanism itself.
I have another question, and that is, is there some kind of a deduction based on the number of dependents in the household?
Yes, and I'm actually going to have Ken Lee come up and talk about that because I think it varies between single and joint filer. So I don't want to get this wrong.
So we do have a $3,000 per pendant deduction. And so going back to your example of the married filing jointly exemption of $30,000, if we have an example of a two-person household married filing jointly, their AGI is $32,000 combined. They have one child. They can claim a one-child deduction of $3,000, which adjusts their AGI down to $29,000. And then, therefore, that $29,000 being lower than that $30,000 threshold exempts them from the actual income tax.
So they don't get a $3,000, one each for the parents and one for the child?
No, the reason why is the $30,000 threshold was actually set by comparing a two-person household at 50% MFI, which is about $30,000. And that's why we had actually set the exemption level at $30,000 based on the feedback we got from the working groups.
So the tax filer does not get an exemption for his or herself.
Correct.
Unlike the federal tax, where you get a deduction for yourself.
Correct. And so correspondingly on the, if you're a single filer, for example, you're making $27,000 AGI. You have one dependent, that's also a $3,000 deduction, and you get that deduction drops you to $24,000, which is lower than the $25,000 threshold, just kind of to illustrate on the single filer side.
Okay, so again, we flagged a couple of issues there. Small businesses on the margin, couples filing jointly, more options to be displayed for us there, but we'll try to pick one for the draft ordinance that at least we hear back from you makes the most sense. Project lists, I'm not sure if there's much. We talked a lot about that. I just want to flag another issue, and that is something that Commissioner Fritz and I talked about. I'm interested, and I think you are as well, in seeing a percentage carved out in the second three-year tranche dedicated to subsidizing not just gravel streets but local improvement districts in neighborhoods that don't have improved streets, because although we know it's going to take a very long time to build out that unbuilt network, I'd like us to start making a down payment on that with this program. And in theory, we start taking down the worst of the safety problems and then might be able to dedicate a small amount of money that might have in the first 3 years have to go to safety to start addressing the LID issue. Obviously, process and criteria to be determined for how much subsidy goes into a project, how much means testing from the neighborhood. But in theory, we ought to be able to say to people that live in a modest house, you know, with people of modest income that live in a modest house on a dirt street, here's an affordable mechanism by which you could pay part of the cost of building out the street in your neighborhood. You have to queue up with lots of other people that are in the same situation, but there's a package here that's being made available sequentially on some basis to either the highest percentage of neighbors who sign up or the worst condition of streets. Again, I think we have work to do on the criteria, but I would like us to make a commitment in this program that over time we're going to start making it possible for people to do those improvements.
I share the concern. I think it's difficult when this package is for safety and maintenance to then start talking about improvements. So it might be that we keep this focused on safety and maintenance, and any discretionary dollars that we have in the general fund budget, we maybe look at some kind of a pilot program for that. Are we going to be doing a charter referral to specify what this is? Oh, that's coming right up. Sorry.
Got that on the list, but we can jump to that, and that is I would still like to see a charter amendment sent to the voters that dedicates the use of these funds to these purposes, maybe does some other things like enshrining the Citizen Oversight Committee and requiring audits. But I think we still need to give the public some assurance that although the City Council is passing this now, there are some guarantees in the City Charter that the voters get to approve about how this is going to work over time. Obviously, we don't want to fence our successors in totally in terms of project selection, but to be able to say it's going to maintenance and safety and street improvements, that there's going to be an oversight committee, that there are going to be audits, seem like the kind of reassurances we ought to offer to the public. So I believe we still should do that. Comments on that question? Again, we're not, this isn't in front of us today, but it's just a question of, do you want to see that?
Would the ordinance to do that come at the same time, or would we do that later?
I think we have both options. Obviously, the effective date of this is such that there's plenty of time to send it to an election later.
Yeah. Could you just tell everybody what the effective date would be?
Where are we now? July 1? No, later. The smiles. I think there may be a technical debate.
Hi, I'm Thomas Lannan with the Bureau of Revenue and Financial Services. We were talking about, if you're referring to an effective date of having revenues available to begin the projects?
No, when do we begin collecting?
Collecting, the first due date for both the business side and for the personal income tax side would be April 15th of 2016.
But, so, Thomas, would we, how quickly do you think that we could set up a system where people who wanted to prepay could do so?
Well, we've talked about that internally. What we'd like to be able to do is offer employer withholding, and voluntary payments, but that probably wouldn't be up at least 6 to 8 months from the word go, from your decision, because we are going to need some time to put together the systems to make sure that that can happen properly and make sure there's no possibility of crediting the wrong account with a payment, those sorts of things.
Another issue to flag is the question of sunset or referral. As you heard, there seems to be consensus among the committees that a referral is now not at this time necessary, but a sunset seems reasonable to me. Again, I don't like binding our successors, but a sunset says to our successors, basically, if this is working, you can renew it, reject it, or refer it. Based on what the council at that time thinks is right to do. We'll have gone through two cycles of project lists and reviews, and that council 6 years from now will have the chance to say, well, this is still working great. We're going to renew it for 6 more years, or, you know, something wonderful has come along and we don't need this anymore. Should that day come, I'd be surprised, but it would be wonderful for them if it did. And we don't need this anymore, so we're going to sunset it. We need to send this to the voters now after 6 years, and that council would have those options. So that's where I'm at on that issue, but any other feedback about that now and later will be helpful.
And then, so you're suggesting 6 years and then council can renew it?
Or refer it. Right.
Or sunset it.
Right. Those would be the all three options would be open to that council. But we'd put a sunset clock on it that would force that question. Another issue, that we need feedback from you now and soon is the nonprofit discount. As you heard from Ruth, there are two options that have been proposed. One's a 50% discount to all nonprofits, and the other is a sliding scale based on their size and dollar volume, right? So that question, like the low-income question, is one of judgment. You know, for us, what do we think is reasonable in terms of a break on taxation to nonprofits based on the fact that they're nonprofits? So that question for me, I could go either way on that particular one. So if there's strong feelings about that, Commissioner Novick, staff and I need to hear it. The city contribution, the public's been pretty clear that we need to show our support for this. One way to do that would be to fund some of the startup costs, or maybe all of the startup costs, with non-PBOT revenues like the general fund, like the bump revenues that we'll be allocating shortly in the fall. There's also the idea of a general fund asset fund that incorporates this and others, but one way or another, again, that people want to see that this is a citywide commitment, not just a new revenue source that's bootstrapping itself into existence.
Just to clarify, my understanding is were we to make some contribution to startup costs, that would be a one-time expense?
Right. Right. There is a startup cost associated with particularly the Revenue Bureau getting geared up to start collecting a couple of new revenue sources.
I mean, there are people, obviously, who think that the city having some skin in the game, which is a phrase I've heard used, means the city should have a greater ongoing general fund commitment to transportation. And I don't think that's unreasonable. However, I do note that the people saying that have intended to say, we think you should cut the police by X amount, parks by X amount, fire by X amount. And those obviously are the kind of choices that we're dealing with. But I do think that at least making an initial contribution of general fund money would go a long way towards winning some goodwill, and we can have a conversation about what we do in the future.
Those are the issues that are pending for us. Our goal is to try to put a version of this into an ordinance and get it in front of the council over the next couple of weeks, and get it in front of the community as well in preparation for a public hearing in November. So any guidance now and soon about those questions or options will be helpful, but obviously the council can still dispose of each of those questions when we get it in front of us as an ordinance.
I just had a request of the commissioner in charge. So we have the letters and emails from 26 work group members. Presumably in the next week or so, you may get supplemental emails, letters, and can we impose on you the same request that you aggregate them and just share them with your colleagues electronically?
I'm glad you brought that up. We will do that. Also want to let anybody watching this know that we're suggesting, I mean, since we are now saying very publicly what are sort of the open issues in this process, we invite the public to weigh in and give their opinion on all of the issues we're discussing here. And I believe that the email we're using right now is ourstreetspdx@portlandoregon.gov. Is that right? So that's ourstreetspdx@portlandoregon.gov.
Other general comments, suggestions, questions, staff requests?
In terms of the caps and the distribution, the challenge, what I'd like to see is more difference at the 41,000, at the middle income levels, from having a more progressive tax.
I'm sorry, Commissioner, I don't quite understand.
There's no difference for the 41K to 62K or the 62 to 83K in their allocation based on whether higher income folks pay $100 a month or $200 a month.
Between 20 and 100, but between 100 and 200.
No.
No,
there's a change for the lower income folks, if it's more progressive, that they get they're at $1.50, but there's no change between four and
well, eight. But there's a huge difference between 20 and 100. You're saying that there's not that big a difference between 100 and 200.
Between 100 and 200, there is no difference between these middle income people.
Exactly. So we could certainly come up with scenarios where instead of the 200 being used to buy down the amount the upper middle income pay, that it's used to more buy down the amount the middle income people pay.
Correct.
And I, for one, agree that that would be worth exploring.
I'd like to see what that looks like.
Absolutely. We can look at a couple of different, several different versions.
Formula.
Yeah.
Okay.
One comment I want to make about the income levels is, as I noted before, my household under the current version of the $100 cap would be paying $32 a month. And it occurred to me the other day that when we did some research on what the typical household is paying in gas taxes and registration fees for their cars, that adds up to about $49 a month. So if you add 32 to that, that would be $81 a month, which happens to be exactly what I pay for my cable TV bill. So for people in my income bracket, the effect of the $32 a month option would be to have me paying the same for a street network and sidewalk network as for cable TV, which doesn't sound that extreme. It's $81. Actually, it's DirecTV, which I would not advise because it doesn't have the Pac-12 network, but I mean,
so
I think that's pretty typical.
Your monthly combined water and sewer bill is less than your cable bill?
There you go.
There he goes again.
I think that's absolutely true, Commissioner. And also my water and sewer bill is very consistent. It's very interesting. So another point I wanted to make about what we're thinking about having high-income people paying in some examples is if we really wanted to bring all of our assets, not just pavement, but the bridges and retaining walls and the signals up to good condition in the next 10 years, that would take not an additional $40 million a year, but an additional $150 million a year. And that's not even counting the safety investments. Now, actually, we're talking now about spending possibly $20 million a year in safety investments, which is what the group that sent the letter supporting sort of the progressive measure said was sort of their bottom line. The business community has said that businesses shouldn't pay more than $20 million a year. So let's say, for the sake of argument, that safety and business contribution kind of cancel each other out. So if you are going to get that $150 million solely from residential payers, given that there's 246,000 households, give or take, in Portland, that would be about $50 a month per household. So I got a letter from somebody representing a business organization the other day saying that anything above $20 a month is confiscatory and is not related to a user fee. Well, actually, if we wanted to really rebuild the system, we'd be charging every household $50 a month. So the mayor suggested that he might fall at $50 a month. If nobody pays $50 a month, then what we'd in effect be saying is that even if we were the richest city on earth, we would not spend enough to restore our transportation system. And I am sympathetic to what the group of organizations said, that people at the higher end should pay more than $50 a month, because I would submit that even if we were the richest city on earth, some rich people would be richer than others. And in order to get to that $50 a month, some people would have to pay more than that. So I just encourage people not to think of $50 a month as this exorbitant thing that we might be asking some rich people to pay, but what all of us would have to pay if we actually built the system. And to think of $200 a month not as many times what we're asking middle-income people to pay, but as only four times as much for people making $500,000 a year and up as we would ask everybody to pay to truly rebuild the system. And another thing that I would add is that it would be easier to think about doing a pure user fee type mechanism where everybody pays about the same if we were in what in my childhood we would have thought is a normal economic recovery where everybody's income is going up. But national statistics show, and unfortunately I think Oregon statistics are much different, that actually only the top 10% has gotten a raise in the past few years when we're theoretically in recovery. Everybody else is seeing their income stagnating or falling, which means it is hard to ask people to pay more, even though we're proposing to do it, when they're not getting a raise. So I just wanted to set some of those points out as a context for the discussion of what we'd ask various income levels to pay.
So before we close, Mayor, do you have four technical questions for Revenue Bureau and PBOT? One is, how are we going to collect the employee counts for each business? How do we know how many employees they have?
So right now we have about 40% of the businesses in Portland are reporting employee counts. We've had this requirement in place for years now. The reason that the percentage isn't higher is because we don't enforce that part of the code. There's no reason. The main reason the city wanted the employee data years and years ago was to get an idea of sort of the demographics of business here in Portland. And so we use that 40% to extrapolate what the rest would look like. But we've never levied a penalty, even though we could, for a business not providing that information, because it's just not critical information for the business license tax. If the city council imposes the non-residential fee that we're talking about here today, then we would need that piece of information on a schedule affirmatively to calculate the amount owed. And at that point, that would become either a presumption or an audit or an enforcement action.
Similarly, how do we find out the square footage of the business? Do you already have that information?
We don't have that information currently. We'd have to get that as a part of the schedule that would be an attachment to the business tax return, and then we would audit those throughout to make sure that it's been reported correctly. We could potentially also look in Multnomah County records on the properties and everything for square footage as well.
then why are we charging a, this is probably more to the commission, why are we charging a fee for our parks or open space?
I thought that we were, I mean, let's say, I thought that we were, that was based on the original premise that every entity was going to be paying some kind of fee. But I'll defer to Jamie, who seems to have an answer to that question.
Do I just have to find it in my papers? We have, here we go. We're looking at, there's some complexities in how we are charging the business fee. And what we're looking at is looking charging the city as one bureau, much like we would charge OHSU or Portland Public Schools. And then there's many different properties within the city entity. And so we would look at square footage and number of employees. So, for example, the Portland building, we'd look at that as one building with all the square footage and the number of employees. So we're still working through, I think, my cheat sheet here. We're looking at all of City of Portland would be paying an annual fee of $117,000 per year. That's down from $450,000 under the previous proposal. So we're still refining some of those numbers and looking at some of the properties. We know that there's some data cleanup. We have some areas that it's right of way that it's unoccupied that it falls into this. So we're still working on the data cleanup.
So I think that's a policy question. I would submit that we're a nonprofit, and so this is really not based so much on trips per day. So that's the question as to, do we want to charge government entities? It's essentially a general fund subsidy to charge parks.
There are other governments besides us, too.
Exactly, yeah. So I think that's something, a detail that needs to be looked at. Similarly, what does recreation signify as a business in Group 2?
I assume it's golf courses and stuff like that. Yeah.
On the back, we have recreation. We have... it's defined as community centers, bowling alleys, multi-purpose recreational facilities, health fitness clubs, movie theaters, live performance facilities, arenas, and stadiums. So it's kind of a catch-all for entertainment and recreation is how it's defined.
So it's kind of a mixture then between income-based or gross revenue and the kind of use. And again, I do question why medical and lodging are in its own higher tax bracket. There doesn't seem to be a nexus to me between additional trips for those uses versus, you know, you go to a health club, you go to the dentist.
Other questions or requests?
Well, I requested earlier, and I think Director Treat will bring that to us, a list, using the list in the materials, which of those projects will be done by the public sector, which will be done by the private sector. I guess I'm also interested in job creation figures associated with each of those projects, or if there's some overall job estimation methodology, but new jobs, either public or private, that could be created by these investments.
Good idea. Thank you. Others, I just want to again reiterate Commissioner Fish's praise for the good work that our bureaus have done in working with some citizens who've given us a lot of their time in exchange for a few cookies. So thank you all, and again for the clarity of presentation and public information. And obviously it's a complicated issue, and I just want to thank you all for a lot of great work. Another point that I've got to reiterate in as we close this session, and we'll have to keep reminding people, this proposal for raising revenue in the city of Portland will pay part of the costs of the street repairs and improvements that we're responsible for. Part of the costs. We are still counting on the Oregon State Legislature next session to adopt a transportation bill, properly funding the state system and local revenue sharing that has always been part of that system. And we're still counting on the federal government, as the Secretary of Transportation pointed out when he was here just a few days ago, that they need to do their job and pass a transportation authorization bill and increase the federal gas tax, as Representative Blumenauer has consistently advocated. So no one should be under the illusion that if we pass this package, the city of Portland is just fine when it comes to transportation. We still need our state and federal partners to do their job. I hope that by taking action here locally, that that will help inspire action at those other two levels of government, but we still need that action to happen.
Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to add one thing, which is that in May and June, we brought a proposal to council, which was mostly what everybody else does. The other 27 cities in the state that have adopted street fees have relied on the IT trip generation manual for what to charge businesses. So that's what we did. The other 27 cities have generally charged the same amount to each household with some variations based on whether it's multifamily or single family. And that's what we did with some discount for low-income people. What the citizen work groups and PBOTs and revenues terrific staff have done over the past few months is to use a term I've heard the mayor use, Portlandized this street revenue proposal. So we now have proposals in front of us that are not what everybody else has done. And I think that we in Portland often agree that that's a good thing.
Paul, appreciate your time, and we'll get responses to all the council's questions. Thanks very much.